Let's see if we can decipher this. I'll tell you we can, and we will, and it's going to blow your mind.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is Theresa May's stillborn Whitehall child sex abuse inquiry chair Fiona Wolfe still in her establishment cover-up job tonight? The victims want Michael Mansfield to chair it, but how crooked is the establishment and will they let him in? Is systemic abuse at the highest levels an uncomfortable taboo which connects Britain and the United States? The Franklin cover-up was thoroughly investigated by Yorkshire TV in the 1990s, but the documentary was never shown to us. We hear a clip from it tonight. Plus, the Israelis close off the Temple Mount and Al-Aqsa Mosque. What's the latest from this well-known religious flashpoint in the heart of Jerusalem? And 3 years after the assassination of Libya's Colonel Gaddafi by a mob, we take a look back at a terror attack the British and American governments blamed on Libya, and hear from the father of one of the passengers that perished over Lockerbie. And joining me on the line now is Flora Swire's father. That's Jim Swire. Hi, Jim, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, Jim, what are your thoughts about the most recent developments with Libya? Because we've been discussing over the last few weeks how actually it looks like quite a lot of the case against Colonel Gaddafi was confected. What are your thoughts about all that?
If you're talking about the case for Gaddafi over Lockerbie, yes, there wasn't a case. I don't think Libya was involved. But in terms of Libya herself, of course, I think she's very sadly becoming another failed state.
Back to 1988, I believe it was, and the Lockerbie accident. What exactly was the cause of it, in your view? Because many people said that this bomb had come on the plane from Libya. What has since transpired that you've discovered that it wasn't quite as we were told?
It wasn't quite. The major thing, really, was the trial in Holland, which I went into believing, of course, that the two accused were guilty, as I'd been told they were. But I emerged from the trial, and I subsequently discovered a number of other people did likewise, satisfied that those two men were nothing to do with it. I don't have any information as to whether the upper echelons like Gaddafi himself were involved, but I don't have any positive information at all that they were, but I'm entirely satisfied that the two men accused were not involved in any way, that the bomb was not put on board originally at Malta, didn't come through Frankfurt Airport, was put on board at Heathrow. And your listeners might be interested to know that the Metropolitan Police examined the situation at Heathrow after Lockerbie and discovered that Heathrow had been broken into airside 16 hours before the Lockerbie disaster, and that the airport, although told by its night watchman that the break-in had occurred, decided to do nothing about it.
Do you mean people actually sort of got in through the fence and actually got to where the
they broke
runway?
In. Yeah, you know those heavy rubber doors, swing doors that they have in some points in airports? There was a pair of those doors closed with a heavy padlock, and during the small hours of the morning before Lockerbie, somebody broke through the padlock and the doors disappeared into airside. And the airport decided they were going to assume that someone had broken out of airside, not in, which was a quite extraordinary thing for them to decide. But the thing you have to realise is that the entire information about the break-in was suppressed until after the trial of the two Libyans. So the court knew nothing about it, and the defence of the Libyans, who were trying to prove that somebody else had been responsible, not the two Libyans from Malta, were denied that information until the verdict had been brought in of guilty. Now, that wasn't a fair trial, and the UN Observer at the time said this didn't represent justice. It was a political show trial, and the effect of the trial was beneficial to those of us who seek the truth, because we learned so many things that were not true, like the idea that the bomb had come with a long-running timer all the way from Malta.
Also, what about warnings? Because I understand that it's always easy to look back with hindsight and say there were warnings, but there weren't just warnings. There were certain people that actually were booked onto that flight that then decided they weren't going to travel, when in fact it was only two-thirds full, I believe.
That's correct. It's only two-thirds full. And after Lockerbie, within the next year or 18 months, President Bush held an inquiry into Lockerbie, and that denied that there was more than one cancellation. And this in the face of the fact that on the U.S. Notice boards in their Moscow embassy, for instance, a notice had been put up saying there were threats to Pan Am. This was before Lockerbie had happened. There were threats to Pan Am, and if anybody from the embassy wanted to travel home for Christmas, they were free to book on a different airline if they were worried. So really, this coupled with the fact that the Bush Commission of Inquiry came to tell us in Britain what the findings were, and we went to talk to them in the US Embassy in Grosvenor Square in London, and one of the members of the commission pulled aside one of the UK relatives during the meeting, and you won't believe what he said to them, what he said to this guy. He said, Mr. Cadman, your government and mine know exactly what happened at Lockerbie, but they're never going to tell.
Well, that's pretty chilling, isn't it?
Chilling, all right.
Tell us some of the things that you've discovered, Jim, over the years then, that have made you question this official story and start to put the case together about what really happened to your daughter.
Yeah. Well, I think there are two things one can most easily pick on. One is the break-in to Heathrow, because we learnt at the trial that there were specialised bombs available to terrorists in 1988, which worked in a particular way. They were made in Damascus by a group who were closely allied to the Iranians, and the Iranians, 6 months before Lockerbie, had an Airbus shot down by an American missile cruiser in the Gulf and had sworn they would get their own revenge for it.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, because I can remember when it first happened, that was one of the first things that was said, is that this is a revenge attack by a Middle Eastern country, possibly Syria or Iran. There was no mention of Libya at all.
Yeah, that's correct, and there wasn't until the investigation had proceeded for about a year or so. But the fascinating thing about the particular bombs that were available to terrorists in 88 was that, first of all, they were made by a group that was affiliated to Iran, although they were working in Syria, and their bombs are very special. They had an air pressure switch in, which kept them totally switched off unless they sensed the drop in pressure. You know the sort of thing when your ears pop when the plane goes up towards cruising altitude, your ears pop because the pressure in the fuselage drops. And these bombs detected that. And what we were told by a senior, this is in court in Zeist, what we were told was that these bombs, the air pressure switch took about 7 minutes to switch on. And what it switched on was a kind of timer called an ice cube timer, which were very crude and had no adjustments at all, and were made in such a way they would run for round about 30 minutes. So it would have taken such a device approximately 7 minutes plus approximately 30 minutes before the bomb would go off, provided the bomb was put on board at the airport of origin of the target flight. The Lockerbie plane flew for 38 minutes. I mean, as an American attorney might say, I rest my case. And it was one of those devices, I'm sure, that was put on board at Heathrow Airport. And I'm sure there were very potent reasons why the break-in at Heathrow was suppressed, thereby wrecking the objectivity of the trial that those two poor Libyans were submitted to.
Now, you've actually met the Libyans, I believe. Can you just tell us what happened when you met them, the people who were accused of the Lockerbie bombing, and what you made of them?
Yeah, the start of it all was that as soon as the indictments against the two Libyans were issued, I went to see Colonel Gaddafi to beseech him to allow the two to be tried. Now, I was very keen that they shouldn't be tried in America, because I thought that if they were, they would be found guilty whether they were guilty or not, and they would be executed, and I don't believe in capital punishment. So I said, together with Professor Robert Black, who's a very senior lawyer from Scotland, we decided the best thing to go for was a neutral country trial, which is what eventually happened, and much to the consternation of everyone except those who were running the prosecution in the court, what came out there showed that the two Libyans were not guilty as tried. But we were trying to persuade Gaddafi to do that. But in terms of the Libyans, one of whom was found guilty, I got to know him really quite well before he died, and I went to see him a few months before he finally died, And even then, although he was in great pain and knew his death was close to hand, he was beseeching me to continue to try to clear him and his family's name of involvement in the Lockerbie disaster. The accusations against him horrified him, because he was in fact not even a senior member of the Libyan intelligence as suggested by the court. And he was very keen that his family's name should be cleared, even if he'd left the planet by the time it became possible. So the situation we're at now is that we have referred the case back to the Scottish Criminal Case Review Commission, and I have trust in them that they will do a fair job of looking at the evidence that we now have, and recommend that there be a further appeal against the verdict. And if you want to hear the other thing that's really devastating about this, that we've found out since the trial ended, is that there was one key piece of forensic information, which was a tiny piece of circuit board. And we have now discovered that the way this tiny piece of circuit board was made, which appeared to show that a long-running timer, which could have come from Libya and from Malta, could have been used, was in fact manufactured by a different technology than the ones used in the timers which Libya possessed, in such a way that the metallic plating on the fragment shown in court turns out to have been done in a way that wasn't in use in industry until several years after Lockerbie had happened. Now, that is tantamount to a realization that somebody with access to the Scottish Police evidential material had manufactured something after Lockerbie with the express intention of perverting the course of justice, because apart from some very shaky evidence from the island of Malta, there was nothing other than this forensic fragment of circuit board that appeared to confirm the idea that the bomb might have come from Malta.
So what's your impression then of the diplomatic service, the Foreign Office, the State Department, and the courts and the justice system, and also, of course, the TV and the media in the way that they've dealt with this case?
Well, I would never have believed what I know now before Lockerbie. I was a very ordinary run-of-the-mill GP in central England, and I believed that the country was run by people that we elected, who did their best to run the country properly, including, according to citizens, their due rights under European Court of Human Rights legislation. But I now discovered that the governments of Britain and America, between them, conspired to ensure that a completely wrong story was presented in court. I don't understand how the judges who tried it were able to reach the conclusion they reached, but I think the right way to go now is to have a properly convened further appeal to overturn the verdict, because it's very clear to us that the people in Whitehall, for instance, are still taking active measures to ensure the truth does not come out. A recent book which revealed the truth about this fragment, together with independent scientific confirmation of the evidence that it couldn't have existed in 1988, Downing Street issued a statement on the morning that book was published, saying the book was an insult to the relatives. Now, this indicates that they had taken the trouble to get hold of the files somehow on this book before it was published in order to look at it. And in saying what they said, they were saying something that would be very welcome to many American relatives, most of whom, for one reason or another, have accepted that they were told the truth in the trial, which clearly we now know they can't have been, because this fragment could not have existed at the time of Lockerbie. It's an extraordinary story, isn't it?
It is. Whitehall, one can understand. I mean, we've got the child sexual abuse Whitehall cover-up ongoing right now. One can understand possibly a cover-up there. Also, you've indicated possibly the judges involved in a cover-up. But surely, even if these two parts of the case, the whole Lockerbie incident, were cover-ups, surely our TV journalists, our radio journalists, our newspaper journalists would be there to expose it and get to the bottom of it.
I have to correct you one thing. I haven't said that the judges were part of a cover-up. All I'm saying is that I can't understand how they reached the verdict that they did on the basis of evidence they've heard. But sorry to put you up on that, but reverting to the media, I think 25 years is just too long for the media to maintain interest in one story. There was intense media interest at the beginning. quite a lot of media interest up until the end of the trial. But when I came out of the trial, they were all saying things to me like, isn't it marvellous they've got one of the bastards who killed your daughter? And I was sitting there slightly stunned, saying, hang on a minute, what about this, what about that, doesn't fit. I don't think this trial was done right. And it wasn't until a little bit after that hullabaloo of choruses about isn't this good news that I discovered some of the heavyweights who agreed that this trial was a complete nonsense and wasn't in fact representing justice at all. And of course one of the things the trial did was to drive a coach and horses through the good name of Scottish justice, and we have to get this sorted out because I think it's so terribly wrong, so evil, that a country like Scotland should have its criminal law system perverted by politics, because it's very clear that American politics, as you've studied the film The Maltese Double Cross, American politics were what lay behind having to find an alternative explanation to the obvious one, which was that Iran was behind this. And I know that the Iranians paid significant money to the group in Syria who made this particular type of bomb that I tried to describe to your listeners.
Now, yes, you mentioned the documentary, Alan Frankovich's documentary, yeah. The Maltese Double Cross. It's quite long. I think it's 2.5 hours or something. But I was quite shocked when I looked into it to discover that this wasn't actually made by any of our television companies. The money for that documentary was put up by the entrepreneur Tiny Rowland.
It was indeed. And I was very grateful indeed to him for doing that. I have to say now that I don't think that Alan Frankovich, who's also died, of course, since this was made, I don't think he quite got it right. I don't think that a passenger who had come from Lebanon brought the bomb unknowingly in his suitcase onto the plane. I think that the bomb was brought into the airport at Heathrow and was in its own suitcase.
Well, that's right, because quite a lot has transpired since that. I mean, he got the film out pretty quickly after, and obviously much, much longer has gone since then, and things have come out since. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip from The Maltese Double Cross, filmed by Alan Frankovich, which actually was a bit of a tussle to even get shown on British television. I think it was eventually shown on Channel 4, wasn't it?
It was Channel 4, and originally have it shown, we had to get Tam Dyal to show it in the House of Commons because there was a prohibition on showing it initially. The government did not want this film shown.
And what about in the United States? Was it shown there?
No. The only place it was shown was in the House of Commons, and one freelance cinema in Glasgow showed it, but that cinema was broken into the night before in an obvious search for the DVDs of the film, and subsequent to the showing there was an attempt at arson.
Goodness me. Anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip from that film, the Alan Frankovich film, The Maltese Double Cross. And we're going to hear a guy called Oswald Lewinter, who was a supposed CIA agent. And his job, apparently, was to leave a false drug trail to Libya. And one of his bosses telling him to do that was a chap called Oliver North.
In 1984, I was undercover, and my base of operations was in Würzburg at the headquarters of the 3rd Infantry Division. And I was contacted by a fellow who worked for Oliver North. I was asked to develop an operation, laying a trail which would lead back to Libya and make it look as though a Libyan effort was behind this to bring drugs into the United States. The way to do this is to make it look as though the material had been shipped from Europe to Libya and then from Libya to the United States. I was buying a precursor for the manufacture of speed and methylbenzyl ketone, which has the same chemical formula as cinnamic acid, which is something harmless that they put into toothpaste as flavoring. I'd buy that and the labels would be switched and the cinnamic acid would be shipped to Libya. Methyl benzyl ketone would be shipped into the United States to the mafia who were paying for it in advance. My instructions were to use Frankfurt, since that was where all the contacts were. I was told to play the role of Muhammad El-Huama, who was a low-level operative in the Libyan service, and if a purchase order or something were needed, I had been provided from headquarters with stationery. I have a sample of the stationery. This is the bill of lading. Libyan Airlines was to be used. And this is the bill of lading for Libyan Airlines, showing that this material is going to Libya. I received, for instance, the funds to do this through the military banking system. This one in Würzburg is a voucher for the receipt of 317,100 German marks. The street value of the drugs that I imported was about $350 million.
Now, Jim Swire, the father of the daughter, Flora Swire, who died in the Lockerbie crash. Jim, what do you make of the drug connection here? Because there apparently, it seems that there may have been a drug run regularly used by somebody on this route that your daughter, the plane that your daughter was flying on.
I think that what Oscar LaWinter says is entirely credible. I think that there were arrangements for importation of drugs on that route, and this was what the Maltese Double Cross film majored on. I don't think that's actually how Lockerbie was done, but I do know somebody else, like De Winter, who is a chap called Dr. Bill Chasey, who took an American congressman to meet the two accused Libyans after the indictments had been issued, and when he got back to the United States, he found all his bank accounts and things had been frozen. And the CIA actually came to him and said they wanted him to take them back to Libya in order to meet the two accused because they wished to eradicate them, in other words, assassinate them. And he refused. And so they made up a false case against this poor guy, Dr. Chasey, and imprisoned him. And they came to him in prison and said, look, if you do what we ask now, we'll spring you from prison today. You'll have no criminal record. And you'll take us to meet these two men. And he still refused, and he served his time in prison and is now running a major charity in Poland, as it happened, but that's not relevant to this story. But there are others, too, who have been seriously disadvantaged by attempting to blow the whistle on how Lockerbie really happened.
Amazing, amazing, Jim.
You wouldn't believe it, would you?
You wouldn't, but let's have a listen now again to a shorter clip from Alan Frankovich's film, and this time where a local radio reporter describes the drugs actually being found in the fields around Lockerbie.
And just asking around people who'd been involved in the investigation afterwards and involved removing the bodies from the hillside, they were able to tell me specific passengers and what they had on them. And one officer also told me how he had to get a farmer passing with a tractor and trailer to help him take a suitcase full of what he presumed to be heroin away from Tundergarth and down to the Dexstar factory where the luggage was being stored once it was recovered from the area around.
And Jim, what about Pan Am? Because it seems that Pan Am is kind of defunct. Do you think that the whole controversy surrounding Lockerbie, the lies, the cover-ups, that sort of thing, were part of the reason that Pan Am went down?
Oh, I think they were a major part of it, yes. I think what you've just let us hear is the voice of a chap called Dr. David Fieldhouse, who helped the police search the site. And amongst other things, one of the bodies that he found was never reported in the official list of people who've been killed. So there may have been 271 people killed, not 270. But the whole thing is surrounded by so many mysteries of these kinds that it's very difficult to get to the bottom of any of it. But Alan Frankovich, who did the Maltese Double Cross, was a very penetrating guy. And when I got to know him well, I arranged by a face-to-face meeting to send him a fax. We were using faxes in those days. And I said, Alan, I'll send you a fax saying that I'm going to speak at such and such a meeting in London, and we'll see what happens. So he said, OK. I sent him the fax, which he received. But that evening, the Evening Standard in London published a report that I was going to speak at the meeting, which was totally false. But it indicated that even in the early days, our communications were being interfered with as well.
What do you think it's taught you? You're trying to bring together some of the evidence that you've accumulated over the years. What do you think ultimately was really behind the Pan Am 103 crash?
I think it's fairly straightforward. The Iranians lost 290 people to a US missile fired in the Gulf. They swore they'd get their revenge. People in the aviation industry told me it would take them 5 or 6 months to do so, which, of course, was the gap till Lockerbie happened. And I think that the Iranians paid considerable money to the group in Damascus in order to provide one of these specialized bombs, which could be got on board a plane and would always explode about 35 to 40 minutes after takeoff, if you could just get access to the luggage compartments of the plane at the airport of origin. And access was obtained, I think, by means of the break-in at Heathrow. And one of the things that keeps me boiling with rage is the fact that nobody really who matters has acknowledged that Heathrow, which had been privatized by the Conservative government not long before, in fact failed to carry its duty out, which would have been minimum duty, having found a major break-in into airside, would have been to suspend all outgoing flights until they found out who'd broken in and why. And they didn't do that. They shirked it. And they have never paid any penalty for that. And I think that the failure to bring that into the public domain gives far too free a hand for slipshod security at Heathrow and other airports to this day.
And what advice, finally, would you have for people who are seeing terror attacks around, as someone that's actually experienced this kind of thing yourself, about how to read it, how to, if possible, penetrate what really happened?
It's very, very difficult. Call me defeatist, if you like, but I feel one can't penetrate the inner echelons of the security services. I got as far as talking to one CIA guy who did tell me about the money that Iran had paid to the Syrian group. I also got as far as knowing that a chap called Vincent Canestraro had been put in charge of accumulating evidence against Gaddafi by President Reagan. And that particular individual American was also transferred and put in charge of the investigation into Lockerbie, although his background was to denigrate Libya with or without valid evidence against Libya. So there was a long ongoing American use for piling blame on Libya rather than anywhere else. And in terms of Iran, of course, there were oil interests and there was the question of American hostages to be freed. You know, the first hostages were freed within a few days of the indictments being issued against Libya instead of against Iran. And one of the first two freed was Terry Waite, who's now signed up to a petition we also have running in Scotland for a full inquiry into all this.
And where do we go from here then?
Oh, well, we're trying to use the Scottish criminal justice system through a further appeal. Rather curiously, we find ourselves fighting to clear the name of the Libyan, Bassid al-Megrahi, who died, who was found guilty, because that seems to be the way forward. At the moment, if we try to ask for an inquiry from anybody, they always say, oh, well, we got one of the bastards, didn't we, look like guilty, they brought in, etc. And if the Scots won't do it, then we'll have to go to the Supreme Court in London. If they won't do it, then we'll have to go to the European courts. But I think we have to try and use the justice system of these two countries, of England and Scotland, to bring this interview open. I have a horror at the very idea of going anywhere near the American justice system, which had offered, incidentally, the people who contributed to the finding of Megrahi being guilty. They contributed the information about him being the buyer of clothing that was found in the wreckage. But we also now know that they knew long before the trial that the American authorities, legal authorities, were offering between $1 and $4 million for anyone whose evidence would contribute to the conviction of the two accused men.
Well, quite a temptation. And I'm going to bring in old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here. Martin, this is a long-running case, the Lockerbie case. Mm. It seems there's still been no closure, certainly for Jim here. What are your thoughts about what you think may have been behind it?
Well, I hear what Jim's been saying about the Iranians, and of course, if it was the Iranians, it would have been to do with the shooting down of the Airbus. But of course, at that stage, Syria was being lined up to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait.
Exactly.
And therefore, the Syrians, for geopolitical reasons, the Americans didn't want to have a row with the Syrians. But I must say, I don't quite buy into this, because if the bomb goes on in Heathrow, I would suggest that that's probably something possibly to do with the internal struggles within the Western security services. They're the kind of people who probably break into Heathrow. How are the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command going to break into Heathrow? Breaking into Damascus, maybe, but Heathrow? I suspect there's some kind of another level again.
I wonder what you make of that, Jim, if you think maybe there was some sort of tussle going on between different factions within the security services.
It's a very interesting suggestion, and the very fact that we were told that both governments knew exactly what happened, but they were never going to tell us. I mean, excuse me, we have a right to know who murdered our people, and we have a right to know why their lives were not protected. We have a right to know why no action was taken over the break-in at Heathrow, whether or not it was connected to Lockerbie. And if it is true that the break-in brought a device that somehow was connected with the Western security services, that only makes it even worse, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but the other thing, point I'd make is that if there was a bomb which exploded on the plane, a circuit board would be vaporised. Anybody, provisional IRA activist or anybody, would tell you that. The circuit board doesn't survive.
No, so, it doesn't.
And of course, what the Megrahi had to be released in the end. If you remember, Alex Salmond released him because he said he was dying and he had to do it, and there was a sort of confected row in the media about it. But as I understand it, he had to release him because a Scottish police inspector was going to testify at Megrahi's appeal, exactly that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene. And of course at that point Alex Salmond has to send the Glasgow police to Langley, Virginia, to interview people from the US with a view to having them extradited, etc.
Now, well, of course that immediately makes you think, well, will the Scottish government find some way to block a further appeal against the Megrahi verdict? And the chances are quite high, unfortunately, that they may, because some time ago, 18 months ago, the Scottish government arranged for a transfer of responsibilities in such a way that if the Scottish Criminal Case Review Commission, who are the people we've applied to for a further appeal, if they recommend a further appeal, the High Court in Edinburgh has now been given the power to reject the suggestions received from the Scottish Criminal Case Review Commission. So it looks as though it may be that the SCCRC will say yes, there should be another appeal, and that that result will be blocked by the High Court. And of course what you're dealing with is a very small clique of top law officers in Scotland, all of whom know each other, go out to dinner with each other, and it's very difficult to find a route that one can trust when one has seen the proceedings in a major international criminal court that we had advised perverted for political reasons. Who can you trust? It's the old question, isn't it, that's summed up in the Latin phrase quis custodiet ipsos custodiensis, which, for those of your listeners who possibly may not speak Latin, means basically who guards the guardians? Who do you trust to deliver truth and justice at the top of the pile?
Point. I would say that your campaign over the years has been a beacon of light in a very dark world, and the Lockerbie incident, as we know, is not the only terrorist incident that's the world's been plagued with over the last 20 or 30 years. But I think, you know, what we try and educate our audience on this show in particular to realise that everything is not what it seems, and you shouldn't just believe the first story you're told by Western intelligence services.
Yeah, and the thing that particularly disturbs me is the difficulty that there was in actually even getting this documentary broadcast. The fact that it's never broadcast in the United States is absolutely shocking, considering that, you know, all the effort that's gone into actually putting all that information together for the public on such an important matter, and that so little has happened since to really get to the truth, apart from the campaigners, Jim, you and your colleagues. Well, anyway, Jim Swire, who lost his daughter Flora on the Lockerbie bombing in 1988, December, I think it was, 1988. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show. More power to your elbow, so bless you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Great to speak to Jim there, Martin. But there is still this lingering doubt, isn't there? This question over the possibility that there were a whole bunch of people. I know Susan Lindauer has written about this, various other people, that there was some kind of attempt by good people in the security services, maybe in the CIA, to possibly daub in some of the bad people, and that the bad people stayed on the ground, the good people were heading off to America, and they never made it.
Well, if people want to check out Susan Lindauer, and you could just do a Google search or any search engine and
find
her.
Who is she?
She's a former CIA agent, and she was actually involved in various things. But eventually, she was basically persecuted and imprisoned in the US. But her line on all of this is that in actual fact, the CIA are drug runners. We were talking about that in the first hour.
Yeah, we mentioned Oliver North.
Oliver North appeared in that. And Oliver North, of course, was definitely involved in bringing massive amounts of cocaine into the United States in order to create a slush fund to fund the CIA's various black activities.
But wasn't he actually convicted, Oliver North?
Well, no, he wasn't convicted. There was a proper inquiry. John Kerry had an inquiry, and various journalists, Robert Parry and
Gary Webb. This is in the Iran-Contra.
The Iran-Contra affair, which is a bit of a misnomer, really, because the real scandal was not that they were swapping arms for hostages. It's the flooding inner city US with crack cocaine in order to fund their activities. And I'm afraid that the CIA and the MI6 are their junior partners, have a massive, overwhelming track record of being involved in drug running. And Susan Lindau's position on this, and I don't know whether it's true, but this is what she says, is that there was an element within the CIA that was involved in drug running. Some people were both flying back to the US to tell the FBI perhaps that the CIA were involved in drug running, but they never got there. Because if you're putting drugs on a plane with a nudge and a wink, then it's quite easy to put a bomb in when you put the drugs on. Now, I don't say that I know what happened, because I don't. But anybody who says that they do know what happened, and it was all the Libyans and everybody else, and that's what this is all about, clearly wrong. And of course, the bigger point is that the Western intelligence services are beyond the law. They are terrorists, they are drug runners, and ultimately the Scottish police, the Irish police, the British police, the Italian police have got to do the police's job, which is arrest the senior people in the intelligence services and put them on trial. And the other alternative, of course, is war. And that's
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Oh, we're hearing about from Jerusalem, as I mentioned at the top of the hour. Abbas is pinning the blame for a dangerous escalation in violence in Jerusalem on Israel's government. Well, he would do. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called the closure of the Temple Mount to all visitors on Thursday, that's yesterday, as a declaration of war, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for calm and civility in Jerusalem following an attempted assassination of Yehuda Glick on Wednesday night. The Palestine Authority chief pinned the blame for the dangerous escalation in violence on the Israeli government, saying the peak was this morning when the Jerusalem leadership decided to close the holy site to all visitors. Martin, this Temple Mount is quite a contended site. It's got one of the most holy places in Islam, but actually it's on the old site of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem.
Yes, and it's obviously a flashpoint. And for example, when Sharon stormed onto the Temple Mount in the 1990s, he kicks off the first Palestinian Intifada. So the more extreme elements in Israel can always provoke a fight by making trouble around the mosque and around the Temple Mount there. And it's very difficult to come to compromises about this, because people on both sides have got not exactly rational beliefs about it. Their beliefs about it are religious beliefs, and therefore not open to kind of interpretation and compromise. So the potential for conflict is always going to be there.
Ultimately, how is this going to be sorted out? Because you've got two religious groups. Actually, if you go back decades, they lived quite peacefully together. But now it seems that there isn't any. It's becoming more and more difficult to do that. Both factions, both the Jewish faction and the Islamic faction, seem to have a kind of extreme element.
Well, I think that's not. I think it's a bit unfair to the Palestinians on that one. There is an agreement about how it's to be managed. The Al-Aqsa Mosque remains under the control of the Muslims, but the Temple Mount or the wall is for the use of the Jewish population. And with reasonable attitudes on both sides, that compromise can continue to exist. But of course, it's the Israeli right wing who often see it as a means of provoking the Palestinians so that they can put off having any serious negotiations about two-state solutions and so on and so forth.
Just a piece of news about this from the Jerusalem Post is Yehuda Glick's condition is slightly improving following the assassination attempt on it. He is a right-wing Israeli activist, Yehuda Glick, and he's remained in a serious but stable condition on Thursday after being shot outside the capital as Menachem Begin Heritage Center late on Wednesday evening.
Well, they claim to have, I was looking at this, so they claim to have killed convicted terrorist, a name there that they've named has actually carried out the attack. Now, of course, when things like this happen, like Lockerbie, an assassination of somebody, even however, you know, whatever their politics, don't always presume that you know who did it, because often you don't. And there are manipulations going on. Modern psychological warfare definitely involves false flag terrorism. That means that you carry out actions in the name of one group, but in actual fact it's a way of blackening people and creating a psychological effect. And it's not always straightforward what's going on.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, we have this ongoing problem with a woman called Fiona Wolfe. She is in charge of Whitehall and Westminster Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry, and she won't leave. She's the second person to run it, Martin. She says she's not a member of the establishment, and yet she's the Lord Mayor of London, which is like the centre of the establishment.
Well, I think that's the fundamental problem she's got. Because she is the Lord Mayor of London, she's not really an appropriate person to be looking into establishment paedophilia, because it's, even if she is genuinely independent, the suspicion is going to be that she isn't. I don't know who should be looking into an inquiry.
Well, there is a petition, which has been put together.
Somebody, not her.
There is a petition which has been put together by people like Valerie Sinison, who we had on this show, who's worked very closely with victims of ritual abuse and child sexual abuse, which is calling for Michael Mansfield QC to run the chair of the inquiry, because ultimately there's no point in having an inquiry if the victims of this abuse don't trust them.
Well, Mike Mansfield probably sounds like a good person to do it. And in relation to this topic, I always mention the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, where it's quite fairly clear that MI5 were using it as a honey trap to get loyalist paramilitaries to in there having underage sex with underage boys, videoing the results, and then using it for purposes of blackmail. And I see that King Cora has been ruled out of part of the of this investigation into elite paedophilia. And the argument being that the Northern Ireland is a different jurisdiction, etc. But I think the real story behind all of this is not just that paedophilia has been going on, but that the intelligence services have been using paedophilia as a political tool, and that's the real scandal.
Well, we're looking tonight at whether systemic abuse at the highest levels is an uncomfortable taboo which connects Britain and the United States. The Franklin cover-up was thoroughly investigated by several people, including Yorkshire TV in the 1990s, but the documentary was never shown, so we're going to hear a clip from it tonight. The documentary is available on the internet. It's pretty disturbing, and it was entitled Conspiracy of Silence.
A Republican from the Midwest, Lawrence E. King, is serving a 15-year prison sentence for a multi-million dollar fraud. But financial crime is only half the story. This is the true story of Lawrence King. It is the story of an evil at the heart of America, of a cover-up at the highest level. One man is attempting to uncover the full story. John DeCamp is among the most highly decorated Vietnam veterans. A former Republican state senator in Lincoln, Nebraska, he is now a lawyer fighting the legacy of Lawrence King's evil network.
It's a web of intrigue that starts in our Holy of Holies, Boys Town, Nebraska, one of the most respected institutions in the United States, and spreads out like a spider web to Washington, D.C., right up to the steps of the nation's capital, the steps of the White House, involves some of the most respected and powerful and richest businessmen in this United States of America. And the centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex and drug dealing and drug couriers, the compromising of politicians, the compromising of businessmen, but worst of all, the corruption of key institutions of government that have the duty and responsibility to make sure these things never happen.
World-famed Boys Town is in the news again.
Made famous by an Oscar-winning film, Boys Town, Nebraska is America's favorite children's charity.
Boys Town was started to be a home for orphans. That was after World War I. And since then, society has changed and the problems of boys have changed. And so now it's a question of taking care of homeless, abandoned, neglected, abused boys, and now girls also.
With cash reserves of $500 million, Boys Town is the richest square mile in the world. It has been granted the privileges of an incorporated town, a Catholic diocese, and a school district for 500 boys and girls. One third of its annual income is raised from public donations, solicited by begging letters and promotional videos.
Located in the heartland of America, Boys Town youth have come from many backgrounds and locales. As they graduate, they shall seek new adventures and head for different places. But always, they shall carry with them the spirit of Boys Town. If you'd like to help Boys Town, send your tax-deductible gift to Father Val Peter, Boys Town, Nebraska, 68010.
That was an extract there from the Yorkshire Television First Tuesday documentary, actually commissioned by the Discovery Channel, who paid $500,000 for the documentary, but it was never shown, Martin. Probably one of the most frightening things about the whole business is that Larry King, who was at the centre of the scandal, was never actually done for child abuse. He was done for some sort of financial crime.
Well, yes, I mean, the De Trou affair in Belgium has a similar kind of topography, and it seems fairly clear what we were hearing about Lockerbie earlier and the King Cora boys home is that I'm afraid the intelligence services, the Western intelligence services and others, are out of control. They are terrorists, they are drug dealers, and they do use paedophilia as a political tool, and eventually the police will have to do their job and arrest those concerned.
So where does do you think the accusation of abuse in Britain stand between the Marc Dutroux affair? I mean, he was a Belgian serial killer and child molester, convicting of kidnapping, torture and sexually abusing six girls from 1995-1996, ranging in age from 8 to 19, four of whom he actually murdered. I mean, you know, where do we stand between the Dutroux affair and the Franklin scandal?
Well, I mean, the point is that these things are going on, and what you find is somebody has to play the role of procurer, for example. If you're with the intelligence services, you want to blackmail somebody, you have to get them involved in something, and then somebody like Dutroux is, or like possibly Jimmy Savile, are basically the procurers who provide the young people to
be
abused.
Okay, but what I don't understand is why the link to, well, possible motives for politicians, political parties, and also top civil servants to be involved in this?
Well, it's quite straightforward, really. I mean, in the modern world, you can't really be drummed out of political office for having an extramarital affair or having gay sex. But on the other hand, we all know that we're very opposed to people having sex with underage children. And, of course, the people who do that have a very hard time in prison. So if a politician or a senior person has been compromised in that way, they are eminently blackmailable. And I'm afraid these kind of dirty tricks go on.
Now, Michael Mansfield might be being possibly fingered as a better kind of person than Fiona Wolf to take over. What's the chance of this inquiry going ahead? Because, of course, the longer we leave it, the less chance there is that information will come out before next year's general election, Martin. Do you think that's a possible
strategy, isn't it? Just keep it kicking it down the road and hope that everybody gets bored of it. But what really worries me is that they've ruled out looking into King Cora, although in Northern Ireland, both loyalist and nationalist politicians are very unhappy about that. They want it looked into. Both sides want it looked into. And I think, just as we were discussing Lockerbie earlier, we've got to get an educated citizenry that is not to be bamboozled by tricks being pulled behind the scenes by people who, at the end of the day, the intelligence services are supposed to be the servants of the public. That's clearly not what's going on. And there's going to have to be a cleaning of the Augean stables.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Rule by banksters. Is it really that simple? We're going to hear now from a man called Aaron Russo. He stood to be the governor of Nevada for the Democratic Party. And he got to know a chap called Nick Rockefeller, who's one of the people very, very close to the United States and really the whole of the NATO power elite. So let's have a listen now to Aaron Russo about his relationship and what he found out from this guy, a top elite chap, Nick Rockefeller.
I had a friend, Nick Rockefeller, okay, who was one of the Rockefeller family. When I was running for governor in Nevada, he came to me, introduced himself to me through an attorney, and we became friends. We started talking about things. I learned an awful lot from Mr. Rockefeller. He was at the house one night, and we would talk, and he started laughing. He said, "Aaron, what do you think women's liberation was about?" I had pretty conventional thinking about it at that point. I said, "I think it's about women having the right to work, getting equal pay with men, just like they won the right to vote." You know, and he started to laugh. I said, "You're an idiot." And I said, "Why am I an idiot?" He said, "Let me tell you what that was about. We, the Rockefellers, funded that. We funded Women's Lib, you know. And we're the ones who got all over the newspapers and television, the Rockefeller Foundation." He says, "And you want to know why?" He says, "There were two primary reasons. And they were, one reason was we couldn't tax half the population before Women's Lib. And the second reason was, now we get the kids in school at an early age. We can indoctrinate the kids how to think, which breaks up the family. The kids start looking at the state as the family, as the school, as the officials, as their family, not as the parents teaching them." And so those are the two primary reasons for Women's Lib, which I thought up to that point was a noble thing. You know, when I saw their intentions behind it, where they were coming from when they created it, the thought of it, I saw the evil behind what I thought was a noble adventure. Well, see, the whole thing is these people control the money, so they make all the rules, you understand? And they put whatever rules they want into effect. It's a phony. If they want to create prosperity, they just print dollars. They just make dollars or put digits into the economy, and then now you have prosperity. You don't have real prosperity. You don't have real manufacturing. You just have money being injected in. It's an infusion of credit,
which only makes the government go into more debt.
But the point I'm trying to make is that by creating this Federal Reserve System, the government now became dependent on these private banks for money, right? So Nick Rockefeller. And one of the things that we used to talk about was the ultimate plan of the banking industry, what they wanted to accomplish. And the goals of the banking industry, not just the Federal Reserve System, but the private banks in Germany and England, all over Italy, all over the world, they all work together. They're all central banks. So the ultimate goal that these people have in mind is the goal to create a one-world government run by the banking industry, run by the bankers, and they're doing it in sections. The European currency, the euro, and the European Constitution is one part of it. Now they're trying to do it in America with the North American Union.
A one-world government run by the banksters. Well, you said bankers, but I say banksters. Martin, is there any prospect of that happening? Because it seems that certainly many countries around the world, the BRICS countries, etc., are pushing back.
Well, yes. I mean, there are different factions out there. It's not just one conspiracy, as it were, by one group of people. And, of course, I would also, just to caveat on what he's saying, lots of people involved in women's liberation had no idea whatever that they were being funded by Rockefeller, if indeed that was the case. What happens is the people with the money want to control all the outcomes. They hedge their bets. That's why in the US you'll find people like Goldman Sachs funding all the political parties. So whoever wins, Goldman Sachs wins.
Okay. What about this business, though, of a banker-controlled political system in the West? Because the thing is that the central banks do seem to be almost not regulated at all by people like the Treasury. If there's a power relation there, the central banks are doing the lending to the government, and actually the government is their servant.
No, well, they're not doing the lending to the government. I mean, but basically, the central banks are run in the US. The Federal Reserve is effectively run by the private banking system. The Bank of England is supposedly independent of the private banks and is owned by the government. But because Jordan Brown made it independent, it does pretty much what the banks want anyway. We've certainly got a financial oligarchy of criminal tendencies, and I put that very clearly. There are criminals, and because they are criminals, they can be arrested and they can be put in prison. The elite is a criminal elite. We could have a whole list of people that need to go to prison. Let's put them there.
Okay, New Germany. This is a magazine in Germany. I translated it on the internet. A rocket specialist from the German military says that the MH17 the airliner, Malaysian airliner, was not shut down by a surface-to-air missile. Also, One of the big stories of the week, Martin, White House opposes Social Security payments to former Nazis. It seems that for many years, actively, the US was recruiting Nazis to use as spies and paying them quite nice, tidy sums as well, and even giving them nice pensions when they went abroad.
Well, yes, the Reinhard Gehlen, who became the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Services, was Hitler's man in Eastern Europe. He was a Gestapo chief. And, of course, lots of Nazis were recruited to the Western Intelligence Services, which is why they carry out Nazi tactics in virtually everything they
do. A bit galling, isn't it, that these Nazis, some of them, are still receiving these Social Security payments whilst our ordinary people in this country are being put on sanctions and giving no money at all?
Well, we're talking about a criminalised elite, and as I've been stressing all evening, what you do with criminals is you arrest them and you put them in prison, and that's the way forward.
OK, final story. China is easing its credit card restrictions. It's allowing Visa and MasterCard to come into China. Is that wise?
Probably not. The Chinese and the Russians are being bullied, as it were, by the Western elites. They've got their own problems. This is a very dangerous and fragile time, and we've got a lot to be scared about.
OK, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. And he'll be on this show next week, talking about Libya. On Monday, Sister Show Dialect at 11 a.m. you can hear more from me. But have a good weekend. You can follow my Twitter feed between shows at Tony Gosling. Have a good weekend. And please do join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let those banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour.
Celebrating live diversity. From the Sky News Centre. Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 has crashed during a test flight over the Mojave Desert in California. Two pilots were aboard. The AP news agency is reporting one person has died and another was seriously injured. Reporter Dominic Waghorn in Washington says something went wrong during a rare test using the ship's rockets.
That's the first time for 9 months. And in those 9 months, reportedly, the rocket fuel mixture has been changed. So a lot of speculation about what that might have caused in terms of today's anomaly.
The head of the government's inquiry into historical child sex abuse has resigned. Fiona Wolf is the second person to step down from the role. She's been criticised over her links to Lord Britton, who's expected to be called to give evidence. Mrs. Wolfe says she knew it was time to go when she realised she didn't have the confidence of the victims.
It has been brewing for some time. Indeed, ever since the issues first arose, I've been worrying about the negative perceptions, and there's been lots of negative comment and innuendo.